Nina Lakhani, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. We're delighted to be hosting you on the Big Green Politics podcast to talk about your book, Who Killed Berta Cáceres? Dams, Death Squads, and an Indigenous Defender's Battle for the Planet.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
For those of you who don't know, Berta Cáceres was a Honduran Indigenous land defender and winner of the 2015 Goldman Environmental Prize, who was murdered in her home in March 2016 following her involvement in a grassroots campaign against the Agua Zarca Dam in western Honduras on the river Gualcarque. This was one of the many movements that Berta Cáceres was involved with, but it proved her last. An already internationally renowned activist with an incisive global analysis, and having gained even greater international prominence since her Goldman Prize, she became, after her death, a symbol of indigenous resistance to corporate extractivism. And her death became emblematic of the fate of so many indigenous land defenders around the world, dying in greater and greater numbers for resisting mega projects, for defending nature, and for challenging corporate power and corruption. The book is, it's such an amazing insight into an incredible activist's life, but also into the history of Honduras and of Central America, and more widely, what the fight against extractivism, against imperialism, and against neoliberalism looks like on the ground. It has lessons in it for us all. So tell us, first of all, where we can find your book.
Thank you. So it's published by Verso, which is a small progressive publisher and based in the UK and the US. So you can go onto the Verso website and order it from there. They're shipping all over the world. So wherever you're listening to this podcast, it will get to you.
You are now based in the US, having been made The Guardian's environmental justice reporter, the first of its kind. But before this, you were based for more than 6 years in mostly Mexico, reporting on Central America. So when did you first come across Berta Cáceres, and what was she like?
Yeah, so I was based in Mexico, reporting there and in, across Central America for, as you say, around 6.5 years. And I first went to Honduras at the end of 2013 when there were going to be elections. And these were meant to be the first sort of free and fair elections after a coup in 2009. And so, and I met Berta under very, very difficult circumstances. I mean, the whole city was, the whole country was militarized, and she was actually on the lam. I mean, there was an arrest warrant out for her, which had been issued for trumped-up charges that had been brought at the behest of DESA, which is the dam company behind Agua Zarca. Yeah, so she was sort of sleeping in different places every night. You know, it was a very tense situation. She invited me. I met her in the capital when she'd just given a press conference to international observers and human rights delegations, denouncing the repression and the pressure and the threats that she and the whole social movement was under, you know, in the run-up to the elections and since the coup, really, you know, in that period. And she invited me to go to her family home in La Esperanza in western Honduras, which is the heart of Lenca territory. You know, a couple of days later, wouldn't give me her phone number, wouldn't give me her address, just told me where to sort of get to and said someone would bring me to her. And yeah, so that's the only interview I did with her. It was like an hour sitting in the garden of the family, you know, her mom's sort of the family home. And she, you know, she was serious, focused, compelling, you know, and just very, very clear, sharp, you know, really, you know, and just made sure in that 1 hour that we had together that I understood really clearly the context of the repression and the violence and the criminalization, which had resulted from her supporting the local Lenca people to oppose this internationally funded dam on their territory, on a river without their permission. You know, that it led to multiple threats. And by the time I met her, she, you know, three of her four kids were studying outside of the country as a safety measure. She was like, you know, moving from house to house every night. And, you know, she was really clear. And she said to me, look, I want to live. I love my country. It doesn't have to be like this. I'm a human rights defender. I'm a social warrior. But when they want to kill me, they're going to kill me. And that, you know, and that, you know, obviously that came true, sadly, you know, less than 3 years later. But she also, you know, she also during that interview, talked about her mom, Doña Austra, who was there. That's the first time I met her. And obviously I've spoken to many people since then. And, you know, that house that we did the interview in is where she, you know, spent most of her childhood. Was a house, it was the focal point. It was a gathering place for progressive and guerrilla fighters from neighboring countries all the way through the dirty wars, you know, when all these civil wars were being fought in neighboring countries like Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, you know, the sort of playing fields of the US and Russia, sort of Cold War, the proxy Cold War. These people were going in and out side of our home, you know, and so just as a kid, she was hearing these stories and sort of putting together, understanding these sort of local battles in a more global and sort of regional context. You know, she was a sponge to all these political discussions, talk of revolution, talk about inequalities and uprisings. And at the same time, you know, her mom, who was a social and political activist, her mom's side of the family were very involved in fighting for change for many years. Her mom was also a nurse and a midwife, and she would accompany her mom from really quite a young age, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13, on foot, you know, or sometimes by horse or donkey, to really rural outposts where indigenous communities had been completely abandoned by the state. There was no transport, there was no communication, there was often no running water, no energy, no basic services like health or education. And she would accompany her mom, who would go to help deliver babies, you know. And so she really, I think those were very formative experiences that she, on one hand, was hearing all this political context, talk of ideology, talk of, you know, fighting against the system, and then seeing the very local sort of manifestation of the global issues, you know, what that means in a country where, why is it that some people have absolutely nothing and other people have a lot, you know, those sort of, and I think those were really formative. And yes, yeah, so I think, and then, you know, as a very young teenager, or as a teenager, I should say, like, she even shortly after giving birth to her first child, her and Salvador Zuniga, father of her children and the co-founder of her organization, they went to fight in that El Salvadoran war effort. They went to accompany the guerrillas, who were, you know, it wasn't about ideology. They could see that they were fighting against with incredibly poor subsistence farmers who were not driven by ideology. They were driven by hunger. They were driven by the necessity to fight for something better, to fight for the ability and the right to be able to plant and to farm plots of land to feed their families, for their kids to be able to go to school and to not die from infectious diseases. You know, so all of that together, I think, was all bubbling away in this cauldron, you know, very formative years. A mom, sisters and brothers, one of her brothers especially, who were very active in the social movement, you know, in Honduras and regionally. And all of that sort of came together as she was like a kid and a young teenager.
I mean, tell us more about the organisation she set up, COPIN.
COPIN, yeah. So COPIN was established in 93 by her and Salvador Zuniga when they came back from the war in El Salvador. And really what they had in mind was, I think it's fair to say it was a bit vague to start with. You know, they wanted to have a social movement. It was to be an unarmed social movement. They'd seen enough bloodshed, you know, they absolutely were against that. And they wanted it to focus on on land, on territory, and then over the next few months, or a few months later, sorry, when there was the uprising in southern Mexico by the Zapatistas, the indigenous people of southern Mexico, it was a real light bulb moment for Bertha. You know, it was like, this is what we must do. We must frame our struggle in terms of indigenous rights, because what indigenous rights mean, land rights mean, territorial rights mean, the right to self-determination, the right to and the responsibilities that go with those rights to protect natural resources, you know, the sort of responsibility of using but not exploiting our natural resources, but the right to, you know, human rights, basic sort of fundamental rights, education and health and all those things. And then that's how they sort of framed. But land and natural resources were always a very much a key part of that. You know, territory, the right to have a say and claim over your own territory was very much how that organisation developed. And in the early days, you know, they had a lot of successes. There were these pivotal weeks and months in 1994, where, I mean, I think was really a genius move by Berta and her colleagues to organise these pilgrim marches. And what started off with, you know, the idea being, okay, Belenca people in Western Honduras, we're going to come down from the mountains and march to Tegucigalpa, the capital, on foot to show that, you know, to show the ruling majority that we're here, we exist, you know, turned into, you know, these pilgrim marches where all of the ethnic groups, all the indigenous people from the country, from the seven different groups, came together and they marched together. And it was a real, I mean, I think a massive moment, because there was nothing in the school books, for example, at that time. The indigenous people had even survived the colonial genocide. You know, there was like, it's like they'd stopped existing. And there they were demanding that they be seen, that they be heard, and demanding a seat at the table, you know. And they did have a whole load of early victories, you know. They were very influential in Honduras signing the International Labour Organization's 169 Treaty, which is about indigenous people and tribal people's right to self-determination. They acquired land titles for more than 200 Lenca communities in that region. They were instrumental in getting their prosecutor's office established to deal with crimes and complaints against indigenous people, particularly the ILO 169. So there were lots of victories that came thick and fast in those early days.
So fast forward more than a decade, and Berta Cáceres and Copin have grown, and Berta is even considering standing as vice president in the Honduran elections as part of a kind of alternative political bloc. And then the coup happens in 2009. Democratically elected president Manuel Zelaya is ousted. Of this moment, you quote one of Berta's daughters, Bertita, as saying, "My mother wanted to build a better Honduras, but that hope died with the coup." So what happens? And why have the coup then, only 6 months before the next elections?
I mean, I think it was a converging of time and place and factors, you know. Zelaya, who was and has been painted as this left-wing, Hugo Chavez-esque leftist radical that was going to bring communism to Honduras, was a traditional landowner. He was anything but radical, but what he had done during his presidency had tried and had implemented some modest reforms, increased the minimum wage by a little bit, you know, try to reform the energy sector, try to investigate long-standing violent land conflicts where subsistence farmers complained of their land being stolen through fraudulent means by, you know, some, you know, industrialists who then converted, you know, fertile lands which fed the country into African palm plantations to sell on the biofuel market or to use for processed food, you know. So there was all of this going on, and he was promising modest change. And so the elections were due in November 2009, as you said. Berta was standing as a vice president on an independent ticket, supported. And so there was this real call, and Zelaya supported this, to reform the constitution. So it actually represented for the very first time a true social contract between the state and the people that was representative of all people, that wasn't designed to serve the interests of just the economic and political and military and religious elites, you know, that it was a really actual social contract. And that also that identified, acknowledged and recognized the rights of all ethnic groups, the indigenous peoples as well in Honduras. And because there'd been this backlash already from, you know, those in control who had no interest in the status quo changing, he had approved a plebiscite that was really a yes-no plebiscite saying, do you want the question of constitutional reform to be on the ballot in the November elections? That was it, right? And even if it had been yes, the Supreme Court and the Congress still had within the law of option of vetoing it. You know, so that was, I think that was part of it. I think it was actually the idea of, you know, these very powerful, deep-seated networks who control all the economic and political wealth in the country, all access to sort of international capital, etc. Thinking, we are not willing to give you a single millimetre. We're not willing to give up anything, not a single cent. And I think within that context, and what we saw then unfold really quickly after the coup, was just the massive sell-off of natural resources. Honduras was sold off, you know, the rivers were sold, were concessioned for hydroelectric dams, land was sold for logging, for monocrops, for biofuels. Massive energy projects were, renewable energy projects were licensed. And all of this happened without any type of proper analysis, debate in Congress, consultation, legally required consultation. It was just a massive sell-off and a complete fraud, you know. I mean, for example, these renewable energy companies signed contracts, often incredibly lucrative contracts with the national energy company, to buy energy at a certain rate, well above market value, for 25 years, you know, which was going to, you know, these contracts were absolutely against the best interests of the Honduran people, right? They were going to benefit a few. And that's what happened. You had a whole wave of new mining concessions happening as well. And I think the thing is, when you talk about these energy projects, and I think what happened after the coup, and certainly Berta was constantly attacked by these people who had interest in these, you know, who'd gone from having interest in dirty fuels to clean fuels, the so-called clean fuels, that well, you know, you're anti-development, we're trying to bring light and energy and civilize Honduras. But actually, in many of these cases, and I've seen this in Honduras and all over the region, the communities in where these projects are imposed don't benefit from them. Their way of life is ruined. They're forcibly displaced. And the energy never arrives there. The energy is often used then to power other destructive projects like mining, or is imported elsewhere. You know, and so I think very much, I think it was a plan, you know, an operative by the ruling elite to not give up a single bit of power, not for anyone or anything, to show people their place, you know, to set an example that this was not going to happen in Honduras. And then to go on a full blown effort to just sell off natural resources to the highest bidder and not give any concession, not give any choice or any consultation to the communities, the rural and indigenous communities, where these projects would be imposed.
I thought I'd read a quote from you and maybe you could comment on it. At the heart of most conflicts over land and natural resources is the failure to obtain free, prior and informed consent from communities before mega projects are sanctioned. Despite everything, the Agua Zarca license has not been revoked and hangs over the Rio Blanco community, which continues to face threats and harassment from a handful of pro-dam neighbours. At the time of writing, the Honduran state continues to circumvent international standards enshrined in the ILO 169 Convention and UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. It is trying to push through a so-called consultation law, promoted by a congressman with alleged ties to drug traffickers, which would in fact undermine meaningful participation by communities. So why are Indigenous rights so important to protecting nature?
I think the fact that Native people of the world, of, you know, of every country, every region, long had a sort of sustainable coexistence with Mother Nature. You know, people took what they needed, not more. You know, there was always an equilibrium. You know, people didn't cut down trees to sell. They cut down trees, or they used trees that had fallen down for firewood. You know, it was a sustainable way of life. Investigate or read about any Indigenous peoples in any continent of the planet, and you will see that, you know. I think as capitalism, neoliberalism, that the neoliberal project began to be just rolled out and imposed on the back of these ideological sort of time, you know, ideological Cold War, which was also about money and resources, I'm absolutely sure as well, you know, but just that sort of rolling out of extraction of actually, you know what, these countries have hidden wealth. It might be under the ground, it's in their trees, it's in their natural resources, and that wealth must be exploited because the project of neoliberalism is money, right? It's about exploitation. There's a hierarchy in that, a hierarchy of who exploits, who makes that money. And there is a huge layer of people, of communities that are collateral damage. And that's all right as far as that economic model is concerned, you know, that the point is to, if there's gold below the ground under a virgin forest, well, we'll cut down the trees to get the gold because that is what the gold is there for. It's to be exploited. You know, it's to be sold on the market. And if extracting that gold means that we're going to use arsenic and we're going to poison rivers, doesn't matter. We need to get the gold. This extractivism model, which we can talk about it in terms of fossil fuels, forests, rivers, you know, now fracking, plastics, all of these things, it's very much part of this same project of maximum profit for a few. And everything else is collateral damage. And that could be that can be people, it can be biodiversity, it can be land, it can be rivers, it can be communities. It doesn't matter. But I think organizations like COPIN and many others were forced to organize and fight and struggle on our behalf as a planet, because there's only one planet. There's only one planet because it's on their doorsteps. It's happening on their doorsteps. You know, it's happening in their territories. It's forcing people to leave their land. It's forcing people to migrate to places they don't want to go to hostile countries, to seek asylum, to lose sustainable ways of life, to lose their sacred spiritual connection with the earth, which is how the planet has lasted so long in the first place, right? Because there were these connections. And they've been forced to do that. They've been forced to be at the forefront of the struggle to save the planet.
Yeah, and the land that's managed by indigenous people around the world, right? It's the most diverse in the world, right?
Yeah.
Not virgin land managed by huge conservation NGOs. Biodiversity is declining less rapidly on indigenous people's land than in other areas. Up to 80% of biodiversity is located on indigenous people's lands, even though they traditionally own or manage only a quarter of all land. We discussed all this in an earlier podcast episode with Chris Lang from Conservation Watch, so check it out. There's also lots of studies about this, and I'll link to some articles in the description box. So Indigenous rights are key to protecting nature. There's already people on the front lines trying to prevent these extractive projects from happening. We don't need to invent anything. We don't need a new international organisation. We just need to support the people already there. So in some ways, perhaps the best thing we can do for the planet worldwide is to fight for the rights of Indigenous people and support their struggles.
Yeah, and we need to, I think the first fundamental point is that these aren't their battles, these are our battles. We have one planet, you know, and these are our battles as humanity, as people. You know, it's not someone else's problem, it's our problem, right? Because when biodiversity is destroyed in any corner of the world, it affects us all. And you're right, it's not about a new big or fancy organisation. It's about supporting these individuals, these communities, these groups. And how do we do that? It's the vast, vast majority, almost all of these social indigenous struggles are peaceful, unarmed struggles, right? But they are pitted against powerful state apparatus, right? Because the links and the overlap between the investors, the economic powers, and, you know, the so-called politicians ruling any country or state or county or whatever are so intertwined. You know, it's not black and white, these are very grey areas. And they have all of the powers, you know, authority and resources at their fingertips. But we have a role to play at that, you know, in terms of consequences. The Agua Zarca Dam, like many big energy projects, many of these big industrial sort of farming projects or whatever, have capital in them. You know, they have national and international capital in them. It's about us taking responsibility from the top, you know, where the decision makers are, uncovering money, following the money, and just not allowing this sort of lack of transparency to continue. We have all got responsibility for this. It's Bertha used to say this all of the time, that she would go to give talks in different places, you know, all over the world, and always say, this isn't just our problem, this is, it's your problem too, you know, we're there suffering this every single day, it's all of our problem. And until we decide or acknowledge and accept that this is a collective battle to save the planet, something happened in a corner of Honduras or Kurdistan or Alaska or Canada or New Zealand or the Philippines, these areas and these things don't exist in isolation. They're all part and parcel of this same ecosystem that we share, you know, that we're all dependent on.
And the fact that those who end up standing up against this destruction, these projects, are Indigenous people, racialized people, women, poor and rural communities, just makes crushing opposition easier, doesn't it? And carrying fewer repercussions.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they are often, almost exclusively, but very often at least, the people with the least political and economic power, you know. And so from an environmental justice point of view, you can see that in different ways, in terms of the resource extraction, absolutely, but also in terms of where the polluting power plants and plastics factories and gas production plants, etc., are located. These don't happen by chance. These are located in what are known as sacrifice zones. People of colour, Indigenous peoples, immigrant communities, low-income communities, who have the least political and economic power, the least power to resist and to fight and to stop, you know, to stop. And the people whose health is considered to be, that people consider it to be, they can be sacrificed, you know, because all of these things, you know, like we know, even before COVID, we knew that communities living in close proximity to these polluting big fossil fuel projects, to these big factories, chemical plants, etc., suffer far worse health outcomes, far worse medical conditions in terms of, you know, and all these diseases that we're now seeing are increasing the risk of death and serious complications from COVID. They're the same factors I'm involved.
And air pollution too. I mean, if you're a person of colour in London, you're more likely to be in an area with really high air pollution, and therefore your lung capacity has been affected by that. And there's also research coming out that, I don't know if you've heard of the magic carpet hypothesis, that perhaps the COVID-19 virus could latch on to air pollution particles and travel that way.
I've heard vaguely about it. I don't know much about it. But I mean, I think you're right in terms of whether it's that, but it's still under investigation. But what we know is that people who live with high levels of air pollution are going to have lungs that are irritated, higher rates of asthma, higher rates of certain cancers, higher rates of COPD and other respiratory conditions, and also are least likely to have access to healthy food. So are more likely to have issues with obesity and diabetes. And all of these have emerged as key risk factors in bad outcomes in COVID.
Yeah, and less likely to have a car, right?
Yeah, less likely to have a car, less likely to be able to work from home, which again has been a major risk factor, you know, in the US where I am, less likely to have access to clean running water. You know, millions of Americans do not have clean running water, you know, and so that has been massively highlighted during the pandemic when you have a highly contagious virus and you have millions of people that cannot wash their hands because they don't have running water, you know, and so, and it's the same communities, native peoples, Indigenous peoples, tribes, people of colour, immigrant communities, low-income communities, who are considered as collateral damage in so many aspects of policymaking.
You also talk in the book about the Garifuna Afro-Honduran community on the North Coast. And Berta Cáceres was very close to a Garifuna leader, Miriam Miranda, who's been opposing Indigenous lands being stolen by the most incredible, lavish, destructive neoliberal projects on the North Coast. And they felt their struggles were really connected because it's all, and you make this point really strongly in the book, it's all about land in the end. And the way Indigenous people, Indigenous communities own land generally across the world, which is collectively, is also, I think, a really important model of a alternative way of thinking about ownership and land compared to our, you know, property-based individual laws about ownership, which we have in the rest of the world. I also appreciate this emphasis on common collective ownership rather than this false dichotomy we often see in politics between the state ownership and private ownership. And that's something I think green politics goes some way to addressing, is having this middle way, this more kind of collective community-based idea of ownership. This translates to, you know, one of the policies I like the most is the land value tax. That's a green policy which taxes people based on the value of their land rather than on the value of their income, and therefore gets more directly to where the real wealth and inequality lies. But, you know, going back to these land grabs we're talking about, they're happening all over the world, of course, and just over the border from Honduras in Mexico, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador is doing similar things to what we're seeing in Honduras, building huge mega projects in the face of enormous opposition from local communities, indigenous communities. So what can Berta Cáceres' life and her death tell us about this wider struggle to protect what are almost the last pieces of land that have been spared so far from exploitation, destruction?
Latin America and the Caribbean is the most dangerous region in the world to defend land and natural resources. It's also the most dangerous region in the world to be a woman. And there are multiple reasons for this. I think partly there is a long and beautiful tradition of communities organizing, of activism, of resistance. But also there are, in many places, impunity is the system. You know, racism is the system and has been since the colonial system was designed. These are not states that I would describe as broken states. I think these are states that are functioning exactly how they were designed to serve the interests of a few. And those people benefiting may have changed somewhat. There may be different people in those areas. And I think you have to add in organized crime into this mix too. But basically, these are how these systems were set up. And so, you know, you see Colombia, since the peace accords were signed, which again, in many conflicts in Latin America, peace has been finally agreed, really in order to open up borders to extractivism. We saw in Guatemala, many years before, in 1996, the peace accords were signed after 36 brutal years of a US-backed dirty war in which 200,000 mainly indigenous peasant farmers were murdered. And the first law that was passed after the peace accords were signed was a mining law, opening up the country for mining, which was written in English.
Oh, wow.
And we've seen that repeated, you know, mining laws written in countries like Honduras by foreign interests, foreign governments with an interest in exploiting those minerals, you know. Colombia has become the most dangerous place for defenders since the peace accords were signed. Targeted killings of people trying to defend their territories, trying to defend natural resources from relentless exploitation and extractivism. Why does this keep happening? Why are these patterns? Because there are no consequences. There are no consequences. You know, impunity reigns. And us in the West, governments may express some outrage, condemn the killings. You know, Berta's murder triggered international outrage. It didn't change much. You know, the post-coup regime, which continues in power, has faced virtually no consequences, not for the coup, not for the sell-off of natural resources, not for turning Honduras into the most dangerous country in the world outside of the war zone, and not for the killing of hundreds of defenders and lawyers and journalists, including Berta Cáceres. You know, and we all have to take responsibility for that. You know, why do European countries continue to do business with Honduras or with any of these countries? Why does the US continue to prop up a regime which has been widely accused by prosecutors inside and outside the country of having intimately close links to drug trafficking and corruption? Why does the US continue to prop up this regime and send in support for its security forces? Why do European countries continue to do business there?
Yeah, I mean, the EU's proposed Mercosur trade deal, the plan is for it to import from South American countries additional tons and tons and tons of beef and ethanol and fruits, mainly from Brazil, a country where the president has increased deforestation enormously, wants to open up the Amazon to exploitation and agriculture, and has declared what some organizations have called a genocide on its own indigenous peoples. I mean, it's incredible.
It is. And the thing is, our leaders, our countries cannot say they don't know. They cannot say, when they say after Bertha was killed, oh, this is terrible. You know, when they can't say they didn't know. They did know because Bertha told them. People told, everybody told them. They cannot say they don't know that these projects are being imposed without the legally required consultation. They are being imposed. And, you know, we cannot talk about clean energy in Europe and the West when these energy projects are covered in blood. You know, when local leaders, farmers, local women are going to jail, are being threatened, are being harassed, are being divided, these communities are being killed. How can we sit and talk about clean energy projects?
You've also written before about the impact of biofuels and so-called green fuels on people in the global south, specifically Latin America.
Yeah, and you know, where are the metals for our cell phones, our mobile phones coming? Our insatiable desire to replace our electronic gadgets every year because that's what we're told that we need. You know, we need the new phone, we need the new tablet, we need the new iPad, you know. Where are these minerals coming from? Because they're not being mined for in London or in the home counties. Where are they coming from? Which communities are being torn apart because of these mining practices, because of the poisons that are used to extract these precious, these sort of rare metals that leave whole communities without a water source because their water is contaminated. I've met in Guatemala, you know, many gold mines often linked to Canadian mining companies. Canadian mining companies have the worst human rights record out of any country across the world. There's been lots of research done on this, how Canadian mining companies are linked to some of the worst human rights records, criminalization, violent social conflict across the world, you know. And in Guatemala, involved in many gold mines, which left communities with poisoned water, you know. And so, and as their kids started to develop skin conditions, respiratory diseases, you know, the mining companies, aided and abetted by the corrupt state, would often, and I've seen this multiple times, claim that it's because Indigenous people didn't know how to look after their children properly, but didn't do proper hygiene, and just poisoning their, you know, rivers. And I've met so many people in these communities have said, you know, just sat and said to me, but you can't drink gold. Like, you can't drink gold, you know. I mean, record profit in a gold company, but we're poisoning our water. In Mexico, 90% of rivers are contaminated. The same is in El Salvador. 90% of rivers are contaminated. In El Salvador, the contamination of surface water plus the urgent climate crisis that is affecting this region of Mexico and Central America, this Mesoamerican corridor, which is a dry corridor, very prone to drought. I mean, it's, you know, if you look at Central America, it's surrounded by water, by oceans and seas, right? So it's really like an island in many ways, you know. It's sort of a long, elongated piece of land. So it's incredibly influenced. Its weather is incredibly influenced by the sea temperature, the ocean temperatures, by, there's increasingly common floods and droughts. You know, my last reporting I did from the region before moving to the US last year was a series we called Running Dry, about water, about how people are starving in Guatemala because of 5 years of drought. And in El Salvador, the water is just running out. And so unless there are radical changes to the exploitation of water for agriculture and the contamination of water, El Salvador will become an unviable country by the end of this century because it will not have water. You know, this is urgent, it's dramatic, and it's now. You see across the globe, you know, of limited water resources. You know, there's examples in Chiapas in Mexico, but this is, you know, you'll see this elsewhere as well, where companies like Coca-Cola and Nestle come in and buy the rights to a water source, you know, to a well. And that water is extracted and either used for bottled water or to manufacture fizzy drinks, and a community is left without a water source. There's nothing more barbaric than that, you know, leaving people without clean water, which we cannot live without.
You talk to so many people in the book, and I love that we heard from Berta's mum, her ex-husband, and then also the man alleged to be part of the plot to kill her, the men awaiting trial in prison for her murder. And of course, she was just one of many activists working to oppose mega projects in Honduras. So why did they target her?
Yeah, I mean, I think Berta was exceptional because of who she was, her abilities, her leadership, her, you know, her intelligence. She was exceptional. Her murder wasn't exceptional. After the coup, between the coup and Berta's murder, and around 200 other land and rights defenders and farming leaders had been murdered. And, you know, the deaths and criminalization has continued since. So in that way, you know, it was exceptional and extraordinary in a sense. She was part of a movement and she was a great leader. And so that's why she was targeted, because I think that her murder, like all the other terror tactics used against her, her organization, her community, the Honduran people, by the post-coup regime and its allies, were to silence detractors, you know, to silence and repress resistance. And I think they tried to silence Berta in so many ways. And when they couldn't, that's why they killed her. It was like the last grand finale of a campaign of terror against her, much as you would have seen during the Cold War, the counterinsurgency, very much like I feel unfolding today in the US, on the streets of the US. You know, these are sort of counterinsurgency tactics, terror tactics being employed to try and silence and stop resistance and mobilizations. But she, you know, she was part of a much bigger movement. But I think, you know, I'm sure that she was targeted and killed because of the impact it would have on the wider social movement. It did have a massive impact. You know, I think it was a terror tactic and it caused terror. It's a huge blow to the social movement, to her people, but to Honduras and to the rest of the region. I mean, I remember when I heard about, you know, I woke up to news that she'd been killed, and I remember saying to my friends, you know, if I can kill Berta Cáceres, I can kill anybody. That was the point. That's what terror is about, right? It's about causing terror far and wide, not just in that person's sort of immediate circle. Wherever you are, whether you're in Russia or in Malaysia or Kenya, that the similar powers playing out, similar sort of things playing out in all of these countries. And she had this amazing ability. I think one of her greatest strengths was to understand local struggles in global context. And I think that's very much to do with this early formation that she had, you know, during the dirty wars and all of that, you know, because she could do that. She could, you know, she spent time with First Nations people in Canada, with Native Americans, you know, she would listen and absorb and learn and then be able to draw and understand that struggle, their struggle, in terms of a broader political, economic, social context. And I think that's what made her unique, and, you know, and it made her dangerous, as you said.
Part of this broader vision was her understanding of imperialism and US involvement, challenging US involvement in the politics of her region and her country. And there's a great example in the book that you relay, told to you by the deposed president, Manuel Zelaya.
Well, yeah, so this is a story that was recounted to me multiple times, always with slightly different, with some different details. But this is the best version I've come up with. And also some of the details were in cables that were then published by WikiLeaks. So the US, you know, absolutely does have a very special relationship with Honduras in the sense that it has had its tentacles, political, economic, military, in that country for decades, right? And they expect the person in charge, the president, to be a man they can do business with. And they expect US interests to be at top of that list of priorities. And so the story goes is that, you know, he did his acceptance speech, was sworn in, etc., and then gets a call from the ambassador of the day, you know, inviting him to lunch. And then he goes over for lunch. And I mean, this is how Elias tells it, you know, that off, you know, they'd had dessert and he gets this envelope and the ambassador says, don't open it until you're back at your home. And he opens it in the car and there's a list of the 10 most important government departments, ministries, you know. And for each one, there was a choice of three people who the US could live with or approved or suggested would be good ministers for those important posts. And Zelaya says he just tore it up and chucked it in the bin, you know, and that was sort of probably the beginning of the end of that relationship. I think when you look at the cables that came over the following months, I think some of those he may have actually taken those suggestions on board. But the relationship, it's true, absolutely, with the US, with Zelaya, fell apart really quite quickly. And because a big part of it was because the US and the economic elites of Honduras refused to give an inch. They refused to negotiate anything, you know. And so Zelaya went to Chavez and to Cuba, you know, looking for more favorable oil prices, for example. Honduras has some of the most expensive energy in the continent, you know, and you could argue that he was pushed into doing that. I think with his priority was the people, then of course he was looking for the best deal, you know. I think it was very much more about that and more about sort of sticking his finger up at the US than it was ever about it having a political alliance with Chavez. I don't think they had a personal or professionally close relationship at all, but that's how it was made out in the end.
The way that the US has been involved in the region, in Honduras, destabilizing, supporting repression and violence, enabling the coup in 2009, the original coup, Obama as president at the time said first, this is a coup. Then Hillary Clinton said a bit later, oh, this isn't a coup, but you know, we're just saying this so we can keep giving aid to Honduras. And both of them calling for new elections rather than supporting the reinstatement of the president, democratically elected president, who was trying. He tried three times to re-enter the country, and there were huge protests in support of him, which, you know, obviously Berta was a part of. I mean, also the well-documented way, I couldn't believe some of the bits in your book about this, the way that the US is complicit and enabling and involved in the drugs trafficking and the violent drugs gangs in Honduras, just incredible. And you described that in 2010, US border control detained over 13,580 Honduran nationals. But that number jumps to 91,000 in 2014. Yeah. So that's a jump from 13,500 to 91,000 in the 4 years after the coup. Then later in 2017, you've got the US endorsing the re-election of President Hernandez, even though the elections, you know, showed really damning evidence of fraud and corruption, internationally critiqued. And here's a quote from the book. The post-election repression and aching impotence triggered another wave of forced migration. The number of Honduran children and families apprehended at the US border jumped 87% between December 2017 and April 2018, while those from El Salvador and Guatemala fell. And four out of five of people traversing Mexico in the migrant caravan, the first one in 2018, which maddened Donald Trump and intensified the inhumane policy of children and parent separation at the border, were Hondurans. Four out of five people in the first migrant caravans were Hondurans. I mean, reading this and thinking again about how US leaders have talked and do talk about migration, the number of children detained by Obama and now by Trump, the hateful rhetoric in the way that, you know, Trump talked about the migrant caravan in 2017, so much hate and disgust. After seeing you so clearly lay out the US's role in making those people have to leave their country, it just made me so angry.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I first moved to Mexico in early 2013 and started, you know, reporting on migrants from Central America, so predominantly Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, which are collectively known as the Northern Triangle, traversing through Mexico overland, dangerous, you know, it's probably the second most dangerous migration passage in the world after that, over, you know, through the sea to Europe. And different risks, you know, risk of organised crime, etc. And, you know, really quite quickly, I realised when I'd be interviewing people en route, I'd be interviewing people who were being deported, who were being sent back to their countries and then leaving again. And I just remember having these conversations with my editor at The Guardian saying, these are not migrants, these are refugees. These people are not leaving through choice. They are being forced to leave by a mix of structural violence, and by that I mean lack of jobs, lack of economic opportunities, lack of education, lack of healthcare. state-sponsored violence, organized crime, impunity, corruption, and just abject poverty and, you know, dire inequalities. That is forced migration. That is, you know, these are refugees. And so, and yeah, and I think hundreds of thousands of Hondurans have fled since the coup. Adam Isaacson, who is a fantastic person who works at the Washington Office for Latin America, he works on their security assistance team and looks a lot at migration. He calculated that 1 in 24 Hondurans last year were detained at the US border. 1 in 24. And so you have this massive exodus of people fleeing these intolerable, undignified conditions. A country where all the rivers have been sold off for hydroelectric power. But if you're in, you know, I think I put this in a book, you know, in parts of the capital, there is sometimes water 1 hour every 3 days. You know, I mean, just sort of a health system that was completely bankrupted by the same corrupt regime that's in power. There's no medicines, there's no healthcare, there's no doctors. You know, the education system has been robbed. Teachers have been, you know, fired. People are leaving in search of basic dignity, of basic sort of opportunities to save themselves and to save their families. And what they increasingly find is this hostile country. You know, it wasn't perfect by any means. There was lots of human rights violations and abuses and wrongdoing going on by many governments before. But what you see with the Trump administration is a total violation and cancellation of international and national laws to shut the borders. At the moment, in the using the sort of front of the COVID pandemic, and just trapping people who are facing all of these different man-made dangers. On top of that, the climate crisis, you know, this whole region is so vulnerable to the impact of the, I mean, it's not just vulnerable, it's happening, droughts, floods, you know. Like, I was trying to do an event today for the book with Bertha's daughter, Bertita, who you mentioned, and there's been raining for the last few days, so there's no energy, you know, it's happening all over the place. And just, yeah, and so all of these factors, and you're creating these conditions where people are trapped in these countries where they cannot eke out even basic subsistence, you know. And so people are fleeing, they're fleeing these dangers, a state which has no interest in protecting them or providing the basic human needs that every person has a right to have.
You can find Nina Lakhani's book on the Versia website, on Waterstones, Abe Books, or on Barnes & Noble's website. You can also find it on Penguin in ebook format too. You can follow Nina Lakhani on Twitter at Nina Lakhani. Thank you so much, Nina, for coming onto the podcast, and I look forward to hearing more from you in your position as environmental justice reporter for The Guardian.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that's our show. You can follow us and show us some love on Twitter at Big Green Paul Pod. You can find us on any podcast apps, iTunes, Spotify, and SoundCloud.
And if you want to help us make green politics more accessible, subscribe and support us by leaving us a rating or a review. Thank you so much, and see you soon.